For the past two decades, CJSF 90.1 FM has been the game-changing radio station people have tuned in to listen, share, discuss, and celebrate. From authors, actors, and entertainers to journalists, business leaders, and sports figures, CJSF has welcomed esteemed guests giving you the best in music, news, and spoken word, undoubtedly changing the sound of community radio since 2003. CJSF, diverse, independent, yours.
Hello, and welcome to the Canadian Philosophy Show. I'm your host for today. My name is Aaron Wang, and the topic is philosophies of dialogue. What is dialogue? The common definition is a conversation between two or more persons, or simply a discussion that's designed to resolve a conflict or a certain issue under contention. Today I'm joined by my co-host, Brandon Brownlee, who is a fourth-year student in the philosophy department at Vancouver Island University. I'm very excited for this topic, mainly because this is something that is supposed to be really obvious in philosophy. Philosophers talk. Everyone knows that. They talk about things. Everyone knows that. And then those things relate the overall nature of the universe. And so Socrates has this idea of theory of the forms, although, as Brandon and I were talking about before the episode, apparently this is not necessarily Socrates' belief, or at least maybe not in its entirety, because his disciple Plato expanded his theory of the forms into his own philosophy, and much of Plato's writing takes place of dialogues between Socrates and other parties, some of which historians dispute as actually being Socrates and just Plato putting words in Socrates' mouth, quite literally. So I'll open the floor to you, and let's get this conversation started.
Yeah, thank you. So I'm interested to talk about this too, because this is something that, it's something that people, in at least whenever Plato and Socrates come up, it always gets asked, what is the relation between Plato and Socrates, specifically like from a theoretical level? Like, are they two distinct people? Do they have distinct ideas? Did one influence the other? That's absolutely true, yes. So we have Socrates, who is a guy who went and walked around and talked to people. One of those people that he kind of encountered slash like swept up with him is Plato. Plato kind of fell in love with Socrates, and from there began, well, first, we have to recognize that Socrates was condemned to death by Athens. It didn't go well for Athens after that. They immediately regretted it, and Plato was not a fan, obviously, because he loved Socrates, just as everyone did. So he kind of begins writing, well, I don't know if he begins writing with Socrates as his sort of, we might call, like, main character, or the our main consistent interlocutor throughout his dialogues, as a sort of homage, but it certainly seems like the experience of dialogue that Socrates kind of, I don't want to say sicked on Athens, but subjected Athens to, certainly influenced his conception of how philosophy was to be done. Now, it's interesting because Plato has some ideas about reality. So, as you alluded to, things like the theory of forms, the idea that there are eternal, immutable, intelligible things that exist independent of the things that appear and which give intelligibility to the world when we glimpse the world, say we see a tree. Insofar as we know the tree, really we're grasping that form which exists in another world. So there's this two-world theory. You bring up that this was Socrates' original idea. This isn't really true, actually. One of the famous things that Socrates was known for was for not knowing anything. Famously, he said that the only thing I know is that I know nothing. It was supposed to be a sort of a stock way of admitting a kind of intellectual humility, but it was also in order to say, to express that he really wasn't teaching anything, because he didn't claim to have anything to teach. And by extension, that means that Socrates wouldn't have had something like a theory of forms to begin laying the groundwork in which he passed over to Plato. He didn't have anything going that he kind of left for people to succeed. He just had this experience of going around and talking to people and kind of picking apart their opinions, their ideas, but always with the eye to the truth. So I don't think that what he was doing... So is that an idea? Is that a sort of thing that he thinks he knows, that by talking to people and cross-examining them in this dialogue, he's able to pare away the superfluous or just the incorrect and get to the truth or the correctness of their opinions, bring out or bring to light what was true about what people said? Is that a thing that Socrates knew? I don't know, but that's certainly something that Plato picked up on and thought that his dialogues could use to go towards something like pre-given theories that Plato had encountered, and which were, by the way, these didn't come from nowhere. Plato is a kind of clash between Socratic dialogue and Pythagoreanism and Parmenidean. There's a lot of, it's an interesting time, the moment that Plato is writing. There's a lot of pre-Socratic philosophers who would go on to influence, they exist before him. Plato is encountering them. Apparently, we know through Aristotle that Plato was a big Heraclitean for a time. And then he said, well, actually, those were kind of my blunder years. And then he grew up and became a Parmenidean or a Pythagorean, which kind of, those two are pretty closely related in any case. But he encounters Socrates, and who gives him a method for inculcating these ideas or teaching them or expressing them. So if I had to kind of summarize this little bit about Plato and Socrates, Socrates didn't found a theory of ideas, but he certainly showed Plato a way of arriving at some kind of truth, because Socrates was going around causing people to experience the truth and falsity of their opinions. And so he was obviously very impressed by that.
I guess that's a really kind of good way of summarizing the Socratic method, is forcing people to experience the truth and falsity of their opinions or beliefs. And that's kind of where we get off to here, is you mentioned the idea of Socratic dialogue. That does seem to be the oldest or one of the oldest things that the discipline of philosophy holds on to for the idea of what dialogue should be and what dialogue is. I mean, obviously, we could talk about a modern concept of dialogue, not in the philosophical sense in terms of actors on film or in a play, where it's literally just people just talking and there's no real greater theme or perspective. But for Socrates, that wasn't really the case, so to speak, because it's true, he talks to all of these people, and all of these conversations, rich people, poor people, people who have higher status, people who have lower status, people who are older, people who are younger, he talks to people from all these different walks of life, always kind of trying to pursue truth. I was doing some other research, and some people say that Socrates was interested in teaching us how to live, that the discipline of philosophy is to answer the question of what is a good life and how should you live. And so, you know, we've wrapped up these questions now, that the purpose of dialogue is to pursue truth, to learn how you should live, and it's something that should be shared with as many people as possible. That seems to be the founding natures of Socratic dialogue. What do you think of that?
Yeah, so I think that's a good observation that you kind of pull out of your research there, that Socrates did kind of change the subject matter of philosophy. Aristotle famously said that Socrates brought philosophy down from heaven onto earth, whereas before this is retrospective, so Aristotle is coming a little bit after Plato, but also contemporaneously. Aristotle is looking back and seeing the pre-Socratics, who are investigating nature and trying to give an articulation of the cosmos. But then Socrates comes along and starts asking questions about human life and concepts that relate to human life. So things like justice and virtue and whatnot. So in that way, he kind of brings it down from this high and mighty investigation of the cosmos, the heavens, brings it down to earth. So that is one interesting thing that Socrates does. It's interesting because it also supplies Socrates with, this just occurs to me now a little bit, but it kind of supplies Socrates with a subject matter for dialogue. It's one thing to discuss dialogically the cosmos, but it's another to discuss dialogically what goes on between us, what goes on in a human life. We can put examples in front of us of justice, of truth and virtue and whatnot. I mean, I think about the Republic and the first real argumentative critique, that the first cross-examination with Cephalus. Or is this with Cephalus? I'm thinking of returning to the sword to the person who's gone mad. Socrates is able to engage in these kind of human-led counterexamples because he's talking about things that actually pertain to our life. They might have a cosmological significance, but the subject matter now is kind of us. We can talk about if your friend loans you their sword and then they go mad and ask for it back, should you return it? Would it be unjust to return the sword to someone who you know is going to use it to harm people? That's a quandary that some people really do unfortunately face. And it's a question-worthy question. So in that regard, yeah, Socrates is doing something like that. And it's amenable to dialogue. That's the thing I think that is interesting for me. It's something that we puzzle out together, asking each other these things. What do your intuitions, you put your intuitions on the table, and then the interlocutor finds something about them that doesn't work. You put it to them and say, okay, well, you say this, but they're asking for it back. Isn't it unjust to not give back what people have loaned you? That's exactly the whole significance of the dialogical method. You're cross-examining each other about your intuitions.
Maybe this is overly simplistic, but it seems that philosophy in the sense of ancient Athens became a tool for renegotiating social norms and what should be ethical, what should be right. And essentially, like there are ways of doing things that we all know are said to be right. In this case, the social rule is that you should always return the things that you hold that are loaned to you. But then if you believe that something bad is going to result from your action, is it right to follow, you know, that social norm if you believe that there's a negative consequence? The question then becomes, do you have a bad social norm that should have, you know, a precondition that, like, you know, like, do we fix how society view things? Or is this an individual problem? Should individuals just always do what society thinks they should do? And then, you know, the results that happen in the future, no one knows what's going to happen in the future. So society might have other rules in place that you don't know about that are going to take care of this for you. And so it's not up to the individual to analyze that type of situation. It's interesting because what dialogue is supposed to be in the philosophical sense seems to be something that matters a great deal to our civilization in particular, the British democratic tradition. it seems like the idea of pursuing truth in a public manner is something that's central to democracy, which in the case of Socrates is very unfortunate because it is the exact pursuit of truth that leads to Socrates's death. And unironically, his chosen death is what leads to the revitalization of democracy in Athens is actually Socrates' death. His decision to die for his beliefs, for his words, and the ability to say those words to whoever he wants in whatever fashion he wants, and not to bow to the elite of his time, creates essentially vibrant or more vibrant democracy in Athens. There's this idea that, you know, we as the people should be able to pursue truth, even if that goes against our prior social conventions. Lots to dig in here, too. It's getting maybe a little bit too abstract for our purposes for the topic of dialogue. So I want to bring in a more modern perspective on dialogue related to Martin Buber's work, I and Thou, and kind of juxtapose that to the more classical philosophical approach. So this approach, and I'll turn things over to Brandon quickly because he is much more familiar with Martin Buber than I am, but essentially there's dialogue is a form of personal relationship in Buber, and I'll just let you jump in here.
Yeah, so if we're going to be talking about the book that he's most known for, I and Thou, I guess the main thing, like, if you wanted the, like, what's the one thing from I and Thou that we're talking about, it's this idea that being in a relationship with someone is different than being in a relationship with something. And I think that maybe that's a little bit reductive, because Buber would say, well, you can be in I-Thou relationships with things, but it would have to be in terms of, like, an I-Thou relationship. I prefer I-You, but I'm going to use I-Thou because that's what everyone knows. But the central thing for Buber is that the I, so you have to think about it like I-1 and I-2. The I that is in, so there's a, I don't think Buber would say that an I, a pure I, can just exist on its own. Maybe there's, like, an I-I relationship, which is, like, this pure swirling narcissism or something like that. But Buber would say you are always in relation to something. And the form of relation which you are in actually constitutes what kind of I is there, right? So if you are in relationship with, like, say you're using your pencil to write, that's an I-it relation. You're not really considering the pencil. You are instrumentally using it. It sort of falls into the background. I mean, that's how tool use kind of is. It's like the tools become an extension of us and they fade away. But not in an I-Thou relationship. When you are in an I-Thou relationship, there's an actual encounter with something else. But significantly, what is different is the I that is in the I-Thou relationship. So that goes back to what I was saying with the I-1 and I-2. The I that is in an I-It relationship is different than the I that is in an I-Thou relationship. So it's in that way that dialogue can actually change us, because the whole that is the I-Thou relationship is constituted by different parts, right? The persistence of the I appears the same because we use this one word, I, but it actually changes because the I that is a part of a different whole has to be a different part then. So it's in that way that Buber says that there's a kind of mystical experience in an I-Thou relation. One not only encounters some kind of, the thing about it is he doesn't want to put, like, a mystical otherness to that. It has to do with the relation itself. So it's the relation between the I and the Thou that makes and you experience it because you're a part of it. It relates to dialogue because dialogue is one way of relating to someone. So language is obviously, maybe it's not relational per se, but it's one way of relating to someone. So when you talk to someone, you're engaged in a sort of linguistic relation. You can talk in terms of, like, well, you go to the cashier and you just, you know, go through the motions or whatever. You kind of instrumentally use them. You're in, like, a linguistic I-it relation with them. But then you could talk to someone too where you're, I mean, listening is one way of, like, listening is a classical way of doing that, but there is a certain way of listening. It's not just hearing them. It's considering their words, sort of not constructing, but trying to understand the words in terms of their own meaning, not trying to use them. But I'm kind of just going, I'm trying to relate. So I'm trying to relate because Buber's book, I and Thou, doesn't just talk about dialogue. Dialogue is one way of doing that, but it's more general than that. It's actually about relations. But that is how you would characterize Buber's idea of I-Thou versus I-It relations, is that actually you're dealing with two wholes, an I-Thou and an I-It, and the parts are different. The I that is in the I-It and the I that is in the I-Thou are different.
I think that's a a clever way of explaining something that seems obvious to some people and then and might seem alien to other people, then you kind of have to just think about it for a little while to figure it out. It is, I guess, to use some obvious examples, like a lot of modern podcasting, or like even like what podcasting is in and of itself, seems to be like, well, just the very definition of I-thou relationships. You have two people speaking words to each other. Neither of them are trying to direct the words in a specific way, although sometimes there are specific questions, but there's essentially a desire to know the other person, to learn from the other person, and to be changed from that in some way, to benefit from that in some way through that interaction, to be changed in a positive way through social interactions. You could say that's the idea behind podcasting. So, I mean, in the basic way, that seems like a watered down version of Socratic dialogue, where in Socratic dialogue, assuming that the theory of forms has, or at least the pursuit of truth is central, you know, like we're going somewhere, we're concerned about a specific matter, we're searching it out, we're trying very hard to understand a specific idea and be as critical as possible with our ideas and our conception of the idea. We want to look at things from multiple perspectives and come to as close as we can to truth. If that's our Socratic perspective, then the relational perspective, well, it's not truth-based, it's subjective. It's, you know, more in the vein of existentialist thinking. And that kind of brings me to the modern confusion of, well, how did we get here? How did we get from Socratic dialogue to relational dialogue? And what does that mean for modern philosophy? Is modern philosophy the project of finding meaning in personal relationships to other people through the form of dialogue? Or is it the intellectual pursuit of truth, searching for immutable characteristics of existence? I definitely think that many people today in philosophy would argue that it's not what Socrates was trying to do. And, well, I mean, you could argue that no philosopher since Socrates has lived as Socrates lived, just going around and talking to people. Every philosopher of note since has been known mainly by their students and their students' writing and the influence those students have had since him.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. It's an interesting observation. I mean, no one, like, there's no real... So, first of all, there is no real, like, heir to Socrates in the simple fact that everyone who has come from us or come from Socrates since has written stuff down. Socrates didn't write anything down. There's a good question why that is. I won't try to answer it right now. Maybe something will come up, but there is that question. Well, Socrates didn't write anything down. Well, I guess one thing that comes to my mind is he felt that the end of philosophy was the dialogue itself. And what do you need to write down after that? If you've done what you need to do, well, then you don't need to write it down. But you asked the question of, well, how did we get from Socratic to sort of relational or dialogical philosophy? I think that's a good question. You would probably want to, or I think one of the ways that you could approach that is to think about what happened to the sort of Socratic experience. So we were talking about Plato a little bit before, and we have to remember that there was an experience that Plato had. He experienced Socrates and Socratic dialogue, and that influenced him and it moved him. Later, that experience comes up in the Platonic dialogues. You read it and you see two people having this dialogue, and it kind of gets the circle going inside yourself where you start thinking dialogically or along the Socratic lines. There's a reading of Aristotle where Aristotle, the essentially founder of Western logic, you could attribute it also to Parmenides and his idea of what is and what is not, but it's more traditionally attributed to Aristotle with the principle of non-contradiction. You could think there is one reading of, or not really a reading because he didn't write anything down, but there's one reading of Socrates where Aristotle's principle of non-contradiction is a sort of reified form of the experience of Socratic dialogue, because in the Socratic dialogue, if you contradict yourself, Socrates calls you on it. He says, well, what's going on here? And then you have to pare it down. It gets sort of reduced to this ultimate dogmatic principle that essentially founds logic. So if you wanted to ask, well, how did we get from Socratic to dialogical or relational philosophy? Well, you could get from Socratic to anything by thinking about Aristotle's usage or his reduction of that experience down to the principle of non-contradiction, that when you're thinking, you can't be in contradiction with yourself. You can't make an exception of certain statements. You have to be consistent. You have to be consistent as a single person in a dialogue with a cross-examiner. There's a huge history of philosophy between Socrates and Buber. So I guess another way to think about that question would be to think, okay, well, how do two philosophies that seem so, or like who have some similarity in this idea of kind of reawakening a dialogical experience, how do we explain the continuity between those, given that there's so much, given that there's so much time between the two? I think one way to answer that might be as simple as saying, well, you don't really have to, I know Buber must have read Plato, come on, but, you don't have to, you know, follow the breadcrumbs of the history of ideas to arrive at this experience, because Socrates arrived at it without the history of ideas. He engaged in reading, if Plato is to be believed, he read Anaxagoras, and he may have spoken with Parmenides, but he didn't have to follow the breadcrumbs of the history of ideas to get to the razor's edge and then say, okay, thinking is the thing that's going to come here. No, he just talked to people. It's an experience people have. Non-philosophers experience this sometimes. They have their own words for it. So Buber very well could have just happened upon an experience of a kind of person-to-person I-thou relation and just had the confidence, the spiritual fortitude to take that experience seriously. I mean, I'm saying that it could have just arisen independently of that. I think he would have been in a position to see that, and I think he would have been able to deduce that out, to see this is what's going on with Socrates. But that he takes it seriously, I think, could very well have just been a kind of, I don't want to say that, oh, it just popped up out of nowhere, but we can do justice to that by saying, well, it happens, you know, whether you're a philosopher or not. And that's perfectly normal. And that's perfectly fine. I mean, it's important that stuff just crops up. These are part of our everyday experience. I think that's why Socrates, if you can kind of dig down and get to that originary experience, that's why it's so powerful. It really does resonate with our experience.
I just want to remind our listeners that you've been listening to the Canadian Philosophy Show. You can find an archive of our shows at tcps.podbean.com. Again, that's tcps.podbean.com. So for our radio listeners, if you want to hear any of the shows again or go back and see some of our past work, I encourage you to do that. I think that you're onto something, that paradoxically, the person of Socrates himself is an exemplification of Martin Buber's principles of I-thou relationships, in that he's going around having these personal